Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Australia India Institute and CUTS International in conversation on critical minerals for security and prosperity, the role the Quad should play. It is very much my pleasure to host this event for the 40th anniversary of CUTS, Consumer Unity and Trust Society, as it's known, international, and to welcome you all here to the Institute in Melbourne today. First, I would like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land in which we gather upon today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. I would very much also like to acknowledge some of our diplomatic corps that have joined us here from the US Consulate and also the Japanese Consulate and also the Indian Consulate, which very much makes us in line with the Quad today, but also, of course, from DFAT as well to make up the Australia part of the Quad. So welcome to all of our diplomatic friends. As many of you would know, the Australia-India Institute is Australia's leading research and policy think tank dedicated to enhancing and promoting a stronger bilateral Australia-India relationship. We aim to increase the policy and public importance of India as a crucial partner in Australia's future and of Australia as a crucial partner in India's future. And we do that through partnership with governments, business and civil society here in Australia and also in India. But today I'm very excited to introduce two esteemed panellists that are joining me here at the Institute in the armchairs. Firstly, to Mr. Pradeep S. Mehta, the Secretary General of CUTS International. Very excited to have you here visiting us from India, Professor, and thank you for joining us. And secondly, I'd like to introduce Associate Professor Mohan Yelashetty from the Department of Civil Engineering at Monash University, a local here in Melbourne, but also someone very well known for his research work in the critical mineral space. Welcome to you, Associate Professor Mohan. So both of these experts are going to talk about the Quad and critical minerals, you know, to really give us a more enriched discussion and to sort of delve in and dig a little bit deeper on this such an important issue. Firstly, a little bit about both of them. Mr. Pradeep Mehta is the founder and Secretary General of the Jaipur-based Consumer Unity and Trust Society, CUTS International. It's a global economic policy research advocacy and networking organisation, or NGO, established in 1983 in India with centres in Nairobi, Lusaka, Hanoi, Accra, Geneva and Washington, D.C. We have to have a CUT set up here in Melbourne, Pradeep. And secondly, Mohan Yelashetty boasts extensive research and academic expertise spanning nearly three decades across esteemed institutions such as Monash, where he currently is based, but also the CSIRO, Yale University and IIT Bombay. So I think, you know, both, if we look at Associate Professor Yelashetty's research interests, they have been quite diverse because they do include critical minerals, which obviously we're going to delve into today. But he is also recognised as a leading authority in sustainable minerals resources and as a global thought leader in that space. Mine rehabilitation and closure, mine tailings and waste. And so it's within that sort of resource trinity that we're going to delve into some of his expertise today. We're also, though, of course, going to delve into the increased regionalization of supply chains, coupled with geopolitical shocks and the uncertainties that have heightened anxieties over energy security, pushing countries to explore ways to diversify and ensure sustainable and resilient supply chains for critical minerals. It's such a pressing issue and such a growth area, I think, for both of our two countries, as the rising global demand, energy demand remains, and with the push for alternate sources of energy that have come to the fore, it's really made critical minerals to come to the forefront of that sort of global competition, but also conversation in terms of new ways forward. A recent paper from Dr. Jeffrey Wilson from ANU on coordinating the Quad on critical minerals stated that no country can achieve a fully sovereign capability in critical minerals, but like-minded partners can do more to friendshore their supply chains. And I think that's where we see these two countries of Australia and India as like-minded partners that have over the years really been working together in the space on a range of areas. Our relationship is now a comprehensive strategic partnership, but particularly in looking at the investment in critical minerals projects, I think both nations are now very much committed to that because both are also committed to meeting net zero targets. One of those ways, of course, is last year both countries announced the India and Australia Critical Minerals Investment Partnership to really develop supply chains between the two countries. But at the Quad level, this is continuing, and we're going to delve into how Japan and the United States, along with Australia and India, are really forging a strong partnership to create that diversity in supply chains, but the sustainability that's required in our supply chains. I know at the Quad leaders meeting last year, which was held, of course, here in Australia, hosted by Australia, discussion was there on securing critical mineral supply chains as one of the topmost priorities for the Quad. The Quad International Standards Cooperation Network and the Quad Principles on Critical and Emerging Technology Standards were both released at that meeting. The same meeting also released the Clean Energy Supply Chains Initiative to accelerate Indo-Pacific's clean energy transition and called, of course, for the diversification of clean energy supply chains in our region. So there is already a bit going on there at the Quad level, and what I'm going to ask our two speakers today is to really sort of delve into this a bit further in terms of what role now the Quad can play. But before we get into any of that, I think we need to start it right back at the basic level. And so, Mohan, I might ask you to go into this first. You know, when we talk about critical minerals, what are we really talking about? You know, what are they? But more importantly, why are they considered essential for the advancement of many sectors? We know that, you know, obviously the high tech, electronics, telecommunications, transport, defence, touch on critical minerals a lot, but why is this so important for our future? What are these critical minerals going to do for us?
Thank you. I think you have made our job so easy that you provided such an exhaustive narrative about the whole issue so well. You articulated it so well. Anyway, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for this lovely opportunity to be at AII to kickstart the 2024 activities around critical minerals. So coming to what are critical minerals, why are they critical? First of all, we need to understand, if you look at majority of the supply chains, they are highly concentrated. The concentration is what makes them critical, first of all. And any disruption of these supply chains could have huge consequences. Okay, let me take back to 2010. You know, Japan was the first to have been impacted by the supply chain kind of imbalance, in a sense. There was a territorial dispute between China and Japan, and China said, we are not going to supply rare earths. And that impacted large section of high-tech industries in Japan. That was the first trigger that world has sort of witnessed. And there are many instances where similar things happened on a repetitive basis. So one is geographical concentration, and they underpin many modern technologies. You spoke of defense, you spoke of renewable energy, you spoke of any gadgets that you look around in this room itself. So they are underpinned by availability of some of these critical minerals. For example, if you look at a printed circuit board, which is in a mobile phone or, you know, one of these flat screens, et cetera, et cetera. Back in 1990s, it composed of about 14 elements of a periodic table. But if you look at today, it is a combination of 45 metals that is packaged into that. Why that is important? Because we need to bring precision. We need to bring the touch sensitivity to our, you know, apparatus. We need to bring power saving abilities. We need to bring sophistication. You know, all of these are the key underpinnings as to why world is behind some of very traditional minerals, but also more exotic minerals. And the list can go on and on. For example, you look at rare earth elements, which are critical. Now, lithium is critical because everyone is trying to have security, you know, power independence or, you know, energy independence like India and Australia. So they are all controlled by one country in a sense, you know. If not necessarily all of that control happens at the elemental level, but, you know, some at the downstream. For example, if you look at lithium, Australia produces about 50% of world's lithium ore and concentrate. 90% of refining and processing occurs in China. It's not that China I'm trying to take on here, but any country, 90% is not good at, you know, like it's, I'm not trying to corner China in any way. And that's where, you know, the criticality needs to be understood in a broader context. It's not the elements, but, and same with rare earths. If you look at about 60% of world's rare earth mining occurs in China, and about 80% processing occurs in China. And if you look at the further downstream, the magnets, if you look at 98.5% of world's magnets come out of China. So that's pretty much the only source of commercially available market in the world today. So you don't want to put all of your eggs into one basket. And if something happens, and we have seen that during COVID, you know, pandemic, how supply chains could be disrupted, and that what are the consequences of that countries could face. So
but clearly, Mohan, you know, our eggs have been placed in one basket, and that is why we find ourselves in this position, I think, as a region, and why the Quad is taking this issue quite seriously. And I'd like to hear from you, Pradeep, in terms of that, because in a sense, do you think, you know, whilst we've got this new way of addressing this sort of bottleneck, in a sense, of the supply chain being monopolized, have we waited too long to get to this point of action of trying to look at diversification of it? And what role really can India play to ensure that diversification becomes real in the not too distant future?
Right. Lisa, if I may, with your kind permission, welcome everybody on behalf of Cuts International, as you pointed out. We are very, very kind of Lisa and the Australia India Institute to host us on one of our 40th anniversary events. We are doing a series of events in Australia this time. We had one yesterday at Canberra, which is looking at the larger trade scenario, not just bilateral, but between India and Australia as to what they could do in the context of the larger trade regime. As some of you may know about Cuts, we are one of the premier NGOs in the world. 40 years ago, that we work on trade policy, etc., and very effectively, as Lisa also pointed out, we also have a center in Geneva, which has been supported by the Australian government since a long time and continues to be supported. So, just to mention that for record. Secondly, we started off in 1983 in a very humble way. We never thought that I'd be sitting here and talking to Australians about, you know, what India-Australia partnership should be about, or Quad, what have you. We started off as a traditional consumer protection organization, ensuring that a consumer gets 1,000 grams when he's promised a kilogram. So that was our... And that time in 1983, and this is relevant to our today's discussion, is we were a socialist economy. So everything was in short supply or black market, or unless you knew somebody, you know, that, you know, somebody like a member of parliament like Lisa, who could, you know, help you even get a bloody telephone connection. It was this horrible time. You wouldn't understand what a telephone connection means for you. Today you can call anywhere in the world in a split second. In those days, we could even make a, could not make a call to the next town and wait for hours and hours and days to get through the trunk exchange. I'm just giving an example of what we started with. And in order to pursue economic liberalization, that look, we have had enough. In 1991, then India, fortunately, we had a very dynamic prime minister and a dynamic finance minister who opened up the economy. Things were done even before, but they were not done in a wholesale manner as happened during Narasimha Rao's time and Dr. Manmohan Singh's time as finance minister. And that is the time when things started changing. And that is where we, then the World Trade Organization was, you know, on the cards. And that is something which we, in the South particularly, we didn't know what the hell is happening. You know, what is this World Trade Organization? It was, instead of Godzilla, it was called Gadzilla. And I'm giving you some very fancy terms that we used at that point of time. Arthur Dunkel, who used to be the Director General of the GATT when the Uruguay round ended, speaking about something which you may not know about, but the Uruguay round was the one which led to the formation of the World Trade Organization. And Arthur Dunkel was so famous in India that there was wall graffiti everywhere, down with Dunkel, down with Dunkel. And Arthur Dunkel was very pleased to see that even if it was negative, he's the only one who's best known in India for this. Now, that was the kind of the atmosphere in which we were working and growing up. And that is when we decided to, you know, look at trade policy as to how does it affect the poor in the Global South, not just India, and therefore we expanded to Africa and South Asia, etc. We did a lot of work across South Asia and Africa, as a consequence of which we have three centers in Africa, Lusaka, Accra, Nairobi, etc. So what it does help us today, it gives us a very wide, worldwide perspective as to, you know, where the world is going and how does it go abroad. And one of the principles of our work was to promote economic democracy. And we believe the market is good, and markets well regulated can help the poor. Ultimately, it was the poor which was there always in our mind. I mean, how do we help create jobs, etc., etc.? And therefore, a lot of this work that we did was a consequence of our understanding about... Now, of course, there are downsides also. Let me not go into the downsides, but the upsides was that there was liberalization. Even in a country like India, those of you are familiar, about more than 300 million people were lifted out of poverty after liberalization happened, trade liberalization and economic liberalization, etc. So those are very good learning lessons for us. And that is when we, as I said, since we were already working internationally, that we got involved with this new initiative of the Indo-Pacific, having very good connections all over the world, including not only centers, but where we don't have centers, like even in, with Melbourne University, we've had partnerships for a long time and work. We've had events with AII many years ago as well. So we were well connected and so on, and we thought it is important for us to be able to research and advocate on issues which affect the humanity across this region. And of course, there are geopolitical problems, geoeconomic problems as well, as Lisa pointed out in her own opening remarks. And Mohan, of course, went much deeper into this area of feminism. Now, we all know that today's time, when climate change has now become such a big threat to humanity, that we require to regulate our consumption and production in a way that we are able to protect the earth and the environment and the biodiversity as well. And one of the things in that is, as Mohan said, that many of the equipment that we are using, the kind of sophistication would lead to lower energy consumption and lower emissions. And therefore, it is important for us to ensure that all the elements or all the inputs which go into the kind of our pursuit for less environmentally burdensome products is done in a manner that can help us to look forward to a better future for my children, my grandchildren, and their grandchildren. Let's not forget. I mean, these are some very important issues which I thought I would highlight. We tend to forget that, you know, the kind of disaster that we are facing today. COP28, which happened in Abu Dhabi, it was quite a disaster. You know, countries are not getting around to deal with these issues in a manner that is required. Fine, we will phase out fossil fuels. Fine. That was a big achievement. I beg your pardon, there's nothing to be, you know, slapping your back about phasing out of fossil fuels. We still need alternate sources of energy. And in that, the whole role of critical minerals and metals plays a very important part. Now, the issue that is central to this discussion is that we have this excellent partnership among the Quad countries and going on beyond to a larger arena of Indo-Pacific and going beyond to some other countries from Europe who are keen to join in this particular initiative. For example, France. With India and France, we have a lot of cooperation. We cannot ignore that fact. And the French also feel that, you know, they are a part of Indo-Pacific, of course. Politically, they are here in some islands or some other, it's owned by them. Whatever that is. So if you look at I come from a policy perspective rather than the technical perspective as Mohan deals with. So I may not be able to go into nitty-gritties of critical minerals, except to say that what I do know about Australia is that it has one of the best repositories of critical minerals. Unfortunately, it's not doing enough. It can do much more to exploit it and help these. Now, what we think politically is important is that these things should lead to very clear coalitions. A strong coalition that will help us to promote. Now, let me give you an example which has not been raised by either of them till now. But very importantly, in the context of critical minerals, is space exploration. India has just opened up the space sector, surprisingly for a former socialist economy. We've now allowed space sector to the private sector. And that is an area where we can, you know, work together in the Quad region in order to ensure that we are able to access space in order to be able to gain some critical inputs for our own, other than what is there in the earth. You see, there is a downside, Mohan, as you would know, and Mohan would also tell us that. The downside to mining of any kind within our earth has an environmental impact. And that is a paper which I've done long ago, that there is an environmental impact of mining. So we can say that, fine, all these minerals are available, but at what cost? So the issue is, Mohan, that you engineers and geologists should look at ways as to how we can mine without, as Lisa pointed out, in a sustainable manner.
I think, Pradeep, you raise a very, very good point there because, I mean, not only have you shared, obviously, India's rise over the past two decades, but, you know, and the way in which India is, you know, obviously signed on to global targets of net zero emissions, and that's something we obviously all share as Quad nations. But, you know, there is a cost in terms of us looking at you know, these critical minerals to helping create, you know, batteries for EVs or solar panels or the like. And I think that is a very interesting proposition that I'd like to ask now Mohan to perhaps to answer, because it really goes to the nature of, are these minerals critical, or are we needing to look at perhaps a closed loop recycling alternative as part of the mix in trying to reach net zero as quad nations? Because there is that other side of the environmental aspect of mining these critical minerals. Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent question, and we all should do everything that we can do. And industry is really good at doing that, not only from environmental standpoint, but economic perspective, because it makes always recycling much cheaper option compared to, you know, producing from the primary ores. For example, if you look at steel, let's take the example of steel, and I'll come back to whether the quantities of recycled material is sufficient to, you know, the projected growth. But if you look at steel, when I was doing my PhD back in 2007, in Australia, from WA, we used to export around 300 tons of iron ore. Iron ore is pretty 60-65%, you know, less of, unlike gold, silver, and, you know, other precious metals. You get about very high concentrations of iron. And today, as we speak, about 850 million tons of iron ore is being shipped from just Australia alone. So that means our consumption has dramatically increased. There's an exponential growth because, you know, we want, for example, if you look at India, you talked about India, the quality of life, like, you know, the what you call the quality of life is sort of going up, and the middle class is raising, and they've got ambitions. And, you know, perhaps when I was growing up as a child in my own village, there were not many cars. If car came, it was a big, you know, exhibition for all of us as kids. You know, we would go and see, you know, oh, this is how seat would look. This is how, you know, that's a kind of situation. But today, almost every household has many cars. That means in order to fulfill that ambitious growth that every country is trying to aspire, we need more materials. And the only way that anything that cannot be naturally grown must come out of a mine. That's what we say, because I'm a proud mining engineer and academic in mining. That's my first thing that I tell my students. Anything that you look around, if anything is not natural, it has come out of a mining. So that's mining is so important in the supply chains. Coming back to recycling, yes, everyone does recycling. For example, if you look at, again, steel, I give you an example. If you produce, steel is produced generally in two different kind of processes. One is basic oxygen furnace, which is you produce iron ore and then you smelt it, refine it, and that's how you prepare steel and iron ore and so iron and so on. Let's say roughly that produces about 2.5 tons of carbon dioxide emissions per ton of steel that you produce. But there's other route. And again, this is very effectively done, not only for environmental reasons, but economic reasons, as I said. So if you produce steel out of electric arc furnace, you only produce about 1 ton of carbon dioxide equivalent per ton of steel that you produce. So there's an economic imperative there. And companies do that quite effectively. And if you look at aluminum, copper, lead, zinc, all of these mainstream metals, the recycling rates are phenomenally high. Wherever we could do, we do, because that is cheaper to produce. But whereas if you look at our growth trajectories and the kind of inputs that we're going to need, how many of you drive Tesla cars? At least a few of you, I guess, yeah? Okay, if you are driving, each Tesla car uses about half a kilogram of neodymium, which is one of the rare earth element, which is used in permanent magnets. So there are motors, and that motors are using kind of, you know, neodymium. And same, if you, and that also requires a battery, and that battery, a Tesla car battery, which is 60 kilowatt hour kind of capacity, which requires about 7 or 8 kilograms of lithium per car. Just imagine if you have to phase out all the fossil fuel cars, the petrol cars, with electric cars, multiply that 7 times millions of cars that you're going to need. So that means you need to have the primary production route active, because you know the production and the requirement is astronomical. And if you calculate that world over, we cannot meet some of these targets that we have set. And that's where, you know, many countries are almost about to default their commitment to net zero. So some countries have pledged 2050, and India took a reasonable stance. I said, I think they have taken to 2070. So again, coming back to your question, yes, recycling is always attractive, but there's only so much that you can recycle.
Okay, Pradeep.
Can I add to what you just said? Just to clarify for the audience, he said something which was a little too technical. But let me explain to you in a very colloquial manner as to what he's talking about. In terms of production of steel, one is you produce it out of iron ore, smelt it. So the other was recycling of scrap steel. There's a lot of scrap which is lying around, and that recycling is done regularly. Now, the important part of that is the other dimension to that particular thing is, in the global geopolitical space, the European Union has come out with what I call carbon border adjustment measures, CBAM, in order to reduce the emissions, in order to encourage you or incentivize you to reduce your emissions, which is going to be very, very difficult. So we see that as a non-tariff barrier. That's another dimension of this whole discussion that we are having. But if you look at the larger trade and environment debate, what is not being addressed are consumption issues. Only production issues are being discussed. For example, beef today is the biggest environmental burden in this earth out of agriculture. Are you willing to give up eating beef? No. I'm telling you the kind of challenges we are looking at, these kind of challenges, and then coming back to this issue about minerals and metals.
Well, Pradeep, I want to ask you about another challenge now.
Sure.
I mean, we've talked a lot so far about the environmental challenge,
yeah.
The fact that there is, you know, the lack of diversity in the supply chains currently. But I want to ask you about the ethical dimension here. Now, there clearly we all agree on the increasing demand in critical minerals. The questions, I think, raised on the ethical dimension during the recent COP28 meeting, particularly by the UN chief, when he said the extraction of critical minerals must be done in a sustainable, fair and just way, I think is firstly a case in point. But the other part I wanted to ask, and this is really where the Quad comes into this space, is that under President Biden, US President Biden, he has really prioritized addressing corruption in critical minerals supply chains. So in terms of the ethical dimension, whether we're looking at sort of the integrity of the supply chain, the sustainability and the fairness within that supply chain, how do you see the Quad as partner nations facilitating that pathway forward?
See, Lisa, corruption is a ubiquitous issue. There's no point trying to single out the same in the context of supply chain. Let me give you an example. Afghanistan. The U.S. military contractors made billions of money, and it was shared all around with the powers that be. I'm just telling you an example of what can happen in this kind of situation. Now, what can Quad do in order to address corruption in supply chain? I don't see that, you know, you can single out or extricate corruption as an issue in the supply chain issue. You have to go around dealing with the kind of this ecosystem as such in order to ensure that minerals are mined with the least environmental burden, number one. Number two is that they are shared equitably across the board, and that it is held as a common property, as a common resource. As we often say, that, you know, everything on the earth is a common resource. But in this particular context, supply chain, it becomes, in the context of critical minerals, it becomes more critical to think about it as a common resource. But the fact is because there is a shortage, number one. Number two is a lot of critical minerals are cornered by China. And China will use its own terms in order to sell it. They're not going to, you know, give it easily, especially when they're talking about Quad. Then there are other issues which will crop up. Other kind of walls, mental walls, are going to crop up in order to do this. It doesn't matter, you know, like you suffer, etc. So coming back to the politics of this, which is what the question was. So there's pointless, you know, let's not divert our attention to look at corruption in supply chains. It's a ubiquitous issue. You can't do anything about it if it is there. I give you an example. I only give you Afghanistan as an example just to show that wherever businessmen find an opportunity to exploit the system, they will do that. It's a human tendency.
But I think as partner nations and those that, you know, that have come together to really find ways of addressing some of these public goods, I think, yeah, as it's called, within the Quad, I think, you know, the United States prioritizing addressing corruption actually looks at the fact that there is this monopoly there currently within supply chains, the fact that these critical minerals are a rare source and that we need to ensure that there are ethical methods and standards as a way forward. I think one example on that I think I want to raise is deep sea mining.
Right.
Because we know that there, you know, whilst Australia does have a lot of these critical minerals, you know, globally there still is a shortage.
Yes.
In terms of what we need for our, you know, technological futures. So deep sea mining could definitely unlock, you know, a massive new resource.
Right.
of critical minerals. But there are massive concerns regarding deep sea mining. How do we ensure that sort of extraction is undertaken in a responsible manner by various state actors, for example?
So there are two issues that we discussed. One is deep sea mining and the other is the issue about corruption and the U.S., etc. See, we all know that U.S. Is fairly a very hypocritical government. There are many ways in which, you know, they do something and say something else. Now, when you're looking at a future regime of Trump, which is bound to come, you're going to be seeing, you know, a lot of new issues coming up. And therefore, we have to be prepared as to how they will, you know, behave in the Quad. He might say that, look, I'm walking out of Quad. So what do you do then? He's prepared to walk out of the WTO, for example, and so on and so forth. So, but anyway, what I'm saying is, there is a little uncertain future in terms of the politics of Quad. Secondly, and therefore addressing corruption, I mean, the kind of corruption charges which Trump is facing yet has had no impact on his political career. And that is happening around the world. If you look at the latest Economist article, in the sense that the kind of leadership which is emerging in the world, it's not at all democratic. They might be elected, but they are not democratic. There's a difference between democracy and elections.
Well, I think we could have a whole other debate on the threats to democracy.
All this has an impact on the ecosystem of what we are talking about. Now, deep sea mining is something which is similar to the kind of issue that I raised, that look, what about space? Perhaps you'll cause less harm and less damage, because deep sea mining itself will have a problem. I'm still reminded of an India-Australia connect on this coal mining, which is the license was given to Adani and that went to the High Court here because it was harming the coral reef. I don't know what the lessons have the Australian public drawn from that. It's a good example, good case study to look at. Mohan, over to you.
Yes. Yeah, so again, bringing back to the critical minerals, not politics too much. So. No, that's true. Very, very true. So geopolitics are part and parcel of critical minerals, and that's why many of the minerals are critical, right? So you talked about ethical issues, and that's where there's a lot being talked about ESG ratings now. But again, I want to give you two examples of where ethics could come into, you know, where world could come into a big dilemma around ethics. Cobalt is another important ingredient for batteries, which is again for each Tesla battery of 60 kilowatt hour capacity, we require about 6 kilograms of cobalt, right? And about 60% of world's cobalt is produced in Congo, DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. And we know, and there's a lot talked about, a lot written about the child labor and exploitation and the, you know, the red cobalt and so on and so forth. So if we were to not take cobalt from Congo, where would we get it from? Because the rest of the world hasn't really come up to producing the demand that world is kind of, you know, asking to produce. Then the other one, rare earths. If you look at rare earths, as I said, China produces the largest quantity of rare earths, about 60%. And the total rare earths that are produced in the world are about 300,000 tons. Not too much. I talked about iron ore, 850 million tons. As against that, rare earths are only 300 tons. And again, if you come to some exotic minerals or metals like gallium, we only produce 300,000 kilograms we're talking of. So very tiny bit, but they're important, right? So first is the largest producer is China, second largest producer is United States, and third largest producer is Myanmar. Why you think there's a coup in Myanmar? So again, the underlying factor is the rare earths. And the way that there are reports by several experts that the way the mining is occurring in Myanmar to extract rare earths, they are literally massacring the environment. So no one cares. As long as I get what I want and I sell it, again, you know, the corruption issues around that. And same with cobalt. So that's one of the important things that we need to fix. And rightly so, even G20 leaders' declaration, they said, you know, we need to have equitable distribution and supply chains spread out so that we don't have problem. And coming to the second question, which is deep sea mining, there's so much. Again, I quote the example of Japan. Japan, you know, in the crisis of rare earths, they said, oh, can we invest in robots-led kind of, you know, deep sea mining? And in their own continental waters, there are a lot of nodules which consisted of rare earths. But again, that economically was not feasible. And one of the important reason why this happens is because when you have monopoly, 90%, 98% supply is controlled by one, they don't want any other country or company to stand up another entity. And if you look at the current rare earth, current lithium prices, they have been slashed because they will flood the market, the cheaply produced, you know, they've got a lot of stocks and then they, you know, that's exactly what is going to happen. And there are certain environmental concerns which we can work around. Like, as you said, any industrial activity will have environmental consequences, but there are ESG, you know, standards that are, especially now, you know, Australian ESG standards are one of the best in the METS sector. So if countries and buyers and sellers start implementing these ESG requirements in more rigorously, I think things will change. But again, it's a lot of big debate happening, you know, where this all should start.
Well, I think with ESG, I mean, again, it's very much in vogue at the moment, but I think it's only as good as its enforcement within states as well. I think that really brings us into the role of the private sector. I mean, we know that the Quad as four nations, it's very much at the G2G level, but we do need, obviously, to engage a lot more with the private sector to ensure that, you know, ESG standards are met. You know, how do you see us in, you know, as four nations ensuring that the private sector recognise the sorts of challenges, be a environmental, ethical or the like, that become part of their DNA as a business in ensuring that we have more, you know, sustainable supply chains of critical minerals? Pradeep?
No, I think that's a very good point. At least we have some indicators on which we can, you know, judge private sector whether they will do that. But you're right. The problem is the enforcement problem. You know, whether the enforcement, we already heard about this sort of, the whole concept of greenwashing. You know, often many corporates, you know, indulge in greenwashing to show that they are very green when they may not be. And I said, let's not forget the fact that private sector, generally speaking, generally, not all of them, would cut corners. Now, how do you ensure that they don't cut corners when it comes to critical issues like the environmental issues? Now, we, incidentally, ESG, we've done a lot of work on that. And we worked on ESGs particularly from the S factor. Nobody talks about S factor. They only talk about E or G. G comes from corporate laws, governance issues. E comes from the kind of pressures that the global community brings upon corporates to be environmentally friendly. S is mainly how they treat workers in their companies. Very few companies even talk about it. Very few investors also talk about workers' rights in their agenda. And when we ask them as to how have you enforced that, they have no answers. The only case we got was from Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, HSBC in India, was that there was a problem in one particular factory, so they withdrew the loan on the issue about workers' rights. So, you know, in the sense, kind of the occupational safety and hazard, OSH standards are very important in order to ensure that workers are well protected in the factory. They fell down, so HSBC said, then we withdrew our loan. That's about it. But was that a universal thing? We don't know. So going back to ESG, the problem is enforcement, which in northern countries like maybe US or Japan or Australia, there might be better enforcement, better understanding, etc. But in a country like India, it's terrible. Except for a few, you know, swallows, but a swallow doesn't make the summer.
Well, I think this is where it's interesting because, you know, India has certainly made a stronger commitment to be part of the Quad, yeah. The Quad 3.0, I think, as we now call it, in its third iteration. And I think this is a really good question to sort of start to conclude on for both of you. And that is about what, you know, really what is India's role in the Quad on this issue of critical minerals? I ask that because obviously we know that last year India hosted the G20, and it was, you know, in its presidency of the G20. One of the clear outcomes of that G20 was that India really is regarded now as the voice of the global south. So, Mohan, you would be very familiar with where these critical minerals are outside of, you know, the Quad countries that we're sort of focusing on here today. Whether or not there are global south countries that are a part of the potential mining of new rare earths, what then is India's role in the Quad on critical minerals? We know the United States is leading in some of this space, very much so in terms of wanting to ensure that diversification in our supply chain away from China and that monopolization that's been there for some time. Of course, we haven't talked today about the Taiwan Strait and that sort of geopolitical tension that's come about because of critical minerals there as well. But I really would like to know from both of you about where you see India's future in the Quad on critical minerals, on it being a voice of the global south, and does it have the ability to really bring those other states to the Quad to be sort of part of new trusted partners to address this issue of diversification of our supply chains on critical minerals?
That's a long question, so I'll need 45 minutes to answer. But anyway, I'll try to be as precise as concise as possible. So first thing, India, inevitable in critical minerals partnership. So India is partnering with Australia in a bilateral way, on a bilateral scale. India, Japan, and Australia, Jai, Japan, Australia, India. You know, Jai Shankar, Honorable Jai Shankar always boasts of, you know, his name being sort of reflected in that. Yes. So the trilateral supply chain resilience partnership, and India is also a partner to the US-led critical minerals security partnership, right? So that's very important, right? But again, coming to what India's role and how we should be going about. In fact, I just finished writing my op-ed. Probably it will be published on both sides in India. And this is, I collaborated with Dr. Ajay Kumar, who was the former Defense Secretary of India and also a distinguished professor at IIT Kanpur. So what you're saying is how Australia-India partnership in around critical minerals is going to be a game changer. Really, it is going to be a game changer because Australia has abundant resources. We've got enormous, because without Australia, world cannot meet net zero targets. Not alone Australia, but world. So that's so significant. And we've got very high ESG standards. And you talked about recycling, but we worked with Geoscience Australia, which is peak geoscience body in the country. And there was a program called Exploring for the Future program. So that was mainly to scan the entire Northern Australia to understand where the minerals are existing. Next big Olympic dams are going to be constructed, or next big Mount Isas are going to come up. So that was the main intent, right? But one of the kind of piggybacking on that major program, they also initiated a program called secondary prospectivity. So we've got a lot of tailings dams in the country. In fact, my own research, that was the first ever research that happened in the country, where we documented 80,000 abandoned mines in the country. Again, small, medium, and large. That was the first of its kind. So there's a lot of these exotic metals that I was talking about, you know, gallium, germanium, indium, rhenium, et cetera, et cetera. About 20 years ago, when I was at mining school, we were only talked about aluminium, iron, lead, zinc, gold, silver. These were the metals that we were interested in. All we discarded into tailings dams. That means all of our tailings dams have got huge potential for some of these high-tech metals that we're going to need for high-tech industries. So why India is important in this equation, and India also is a mining country, a lot of mining know-how. Japan, again, depends 100% on imports. For Japan and India, even coking coal is a critical mineral, by the way, and so is for European Union, because coking coal is required for steel manufacturing. So what I'm trying to say is why India and how India? India is going to be playing a very crucial role because India has demand. India has demography, because one of the important reason why China becomes very competitive is they saw this. In fact, one of their presidents in 1990s itself said, you know, if Middle East has oil, we have rare earths. So that's a kind of investment and thinking that they have had 1990s when world was sleeping. So they created massive infrastructure, and they got one of the cheapest labors in the world. So about $6 a day of per person. And India has that advantage, similar advantage, because India's, if you look at India's labor, is also highly competitive. We got $2 a day. So that means we can be competitive on global market, compete China. And India also has got a lot of mining states where mining infrastructure and skills, because skills is one other important thing that countries have to invest. And if you look at Chinese Rare Earth Society, which was established in 1982, has 100,000 members, professional members on it. So that shows their commitment and that farsightedness. So India has demand, India has demography, India has rule-based order, and India can protect the rights of their own producers. Because one of the important thing why Western companies don't stand against Chinese, you know, kind of, you know, the price, et cetera, et cetera. Even recently, if you look at Vital Metals, which is ASX listed company, they used to have Vital Metals Canada subsidiary. They had a rare earth mine, and they were contracted by Norway to supply 2,000 tons of cerium-reduced rare earths to Norway. And suddenly China flooded the market, and they undercut, and then this company ran into bankruptcy. But why India? Again, sorry, I'm taking a little long time, but a very important point I'm making. In fact, that's going to be in part of my op-ed as well. I was reading some reports like during Diwali and Ganesh Chaturthi. These are the two festivals that are celebrated across India. The reports say they have put some dollar numbers. Prime Minister of India, Modi ji, has called all the countrymen and, you know, country people to go for vocal for local. That's a new abhiyan or new kind of mission. What they said is don't buy anything external. And in a lot of manufacturing factories in China, they produced a lot of what India is going to need for those two festivals. They knew, right? That has been happening for the last several decades. And apparently, as a consequence of that, these companies incurred about $12 billion worth of losses. That means people started buying local, and they... And India was the only country which banned 200 apps in one stroke of signature, you know, a pen. So how India can protect their own producers' interests? Because they've got demand, they've got demography, you know, the people, the labor cost, and they've got mining infrastructure. They've got technical know-how. So they can also insulate from external shocks. And that's where the government role is very, very crucial, because of that undercutting, so government has to come as a risk absorber in critical minerals if you have to stand up a company. So I think that's where I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohan. And Pradeep.
Yeah, Mohan has touched on some very, very interesting granular details of this. Let me get back to the more macro and important things about responding to Lisa about India's leadership of the global south, which is emerging. I mean, it is expanding. We've always had a very good relation with most poor countries in the world, Africa and Asia particularly. Even in Latin America, we have. In Africa, we, of course, had shared the common legacy of colonialism, the British colonialism. So we have the Commonwealth, which again is a binding factor, of which even Australia is a member. So is Canada. Now, the G20 meeting, which took place in Delhi, there were two important things to be noted, which I would like to flag. And you may know about it, but there's no harm in reminding you. After 17 years of G20 meetings, it was the first ever time that a unanimous declaration was adopted, thanks to India's diplomatic skills. 17 years. All the other declarations have been chairman's text. They have not been widely... particularly in the context of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which has often muddied the waters of any international arena. I'll not go into that detail, but it's very interesting to understand as to how the Russia-Ukraine conflict has influenced a very large number of global debates and will influence even the critical minerals debate in one manner or the other. You can't avoid many of these things. They're all interconnected. Because politically, you have to have some understanding, some or the other. So India has now established. What it did was, even before the G20 summit, was to organize a global South summit, which they're going to do again and again. And as I said, in spite of China being a very heavy investor in Africa, India still enjoys an advantage over China in terms of the personal relations that we have. We have three centers in Africa. As I said, we've been working there for 25 years. And the kind of respect and affection that we get, Chinese don't. Anyway, Chinese don't speak English, number one. Number two is they don't even mix up with the locals. Unlike Indians who are mixing up, intermarrying and doing all kinds of things, you know. We have a large expat population also in Africa, as in India. So that these factors matter a lot in many of the debates which shape the ecosystem. And therefore, when you're looking at critical minerals, Congo, for example, he gave you the example of cobalt. With India, Congo has an excellent relation with India. So whether others approach it or not, in order to mine cobalt, India would be there up ahead. Now, there are political issues with many of these issues are concerned. But fortunately, India is able to get around them because of its own standing and its own relationship with many of these countries. So India will play a big role, and that is what the Quad must ensure, that India plays it in a responsible manner and an environmentally sustainable manner. That is what my biggest worry is.
I think talking about relationships and the Quad, I think, is a really good way for us to close this discussion today, because I think one thing we can be assured on, despite all of the challenges and perhaps the different ways of operating of our four Quad countries, we have become, through our relationships, trusted partners. We are now together there as four countries, the United States, Japan, Australia and India. And I have to say it's an exciting time to be working in the Australia-India space, when it can be broadened into including other trusted partners that Australia has had long association and friendships and alliances with. And of course, Japan and the United States are there, but France, of course, we're back on a good relationship with now, so that's pleasing as well. I want to really thank both Mohan and Pradeep and ask our audience here to join me in thanking them for this really enriching discussion we've had today on critical minerals and the role the Quad could play. Thank you.